Talking Bollocks with FBT Gyms. Unleash your potential at FBT Gyms, where strength meets community. FBTGyms.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up in. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Go down. Go down. Go down.
Episode 213 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly supported by FBT Gyms.
FBT Gyms is the best in the business, giving you so much more than your average gym.
Join us in a supportive environment dedicated to helping you achieve your fitness goals, with locations in Swords, Coolock, Drogheda, and the new location now open in Tallaght.
Whether you're a beginner or a seasoned athlete, FBT provide resources, motivation, and expertise to empower your fitness journey. Unleash your potential at FBT Gym for only €44 a month with no contract and full class access. Sign up at fbtgyms.ie today.
It's me, COB.
It's me, Terry Flower.
And today we're joined by
Dermot Whelan.
A very familiar voice around there, Dermot. I was joking on the way in. He's like the Lord Mayor, Terence. He's going around shaking hands and waving and hugging, kissing babies and what have you.
Going around blessing people and all that. Yeah.
Everyone knows him around there. That's what Siobhan was like, do you want to go out and get Dermot? I was like, I can't. He's out there just chatting to everybody.
He's mobbed.
Just leave him.
What it looked like when I used to work in this building, you know, if the person who left kept coming back, you're like, oh, Jesus, will they ever just go? You know, it would be like, I remember the year before we had children, you know, the thing of when someone has a baby, then they bring the baby comes into work day and everyone goes, oh, look at the. And I remember Dave would be downstairs, be like, oh, God's sake, I hate the baby thing. You know, because I think it just doesn't come naturally to us men. I don't think when the pram comes in, we go, okay, what's the etiquette? What do I say? Beautiful baby, congratulations. Are you getting any sleep? You know, I think women just are naturally know what to say, but I think we have to work a little bit harder at that thing.
They're good at the baby talk and all as well, aren't they? Like, what do we do?
I always wondered about that, like, you know, because you're sitting walking with this woman for like 6 or 7 months and she's pregnant and you can see her becoming more and more pregnant. And then she goes away for a few months and comes back with a baby. I'm like, I believe you. You didn't have to come in and show me the baby. Like, I believed you were having the baby. You know what I mean? Like, why are you coming in and show me? Look, I was pregnant. I was like, I know. You know, you don't need to show me the baby. We interrupt our walk to bring your baby Alex, and I'm like, oh yeah, thanks, I'm going to go back to my desk now.
Well, we struggle with the baby one, but if someone brings their dog into work, then you're fully on board.
It's game over, there's not a tap getting done that day.
So maybe it could be a tip. Bring the pram in by all means, but just put a dog in there. It'll be easier for us.
Yeah. The receptionist here used to have a dog.
Yeah, remember? He used to just sit on the desk out there when you walked in. It was bright.
Just lifts the mood of everybody.
Yeah.
And then you can't understand the people who don't care about the dog. You know, like, all the dog has to do is just appear and you're like, the dog! And there's some people like, whatever, don't care about the dog.
Hurts my heart that when I'm walking my dog and people just look at it. I'm like, that, don't just look at my dog like that, you know?
Yeah, appreciate.
Most people smile at the dog. Some people just look at it and I go, ugh.
What does your dog look like?
Oh, she's beautiful. She's only,
maybe your dog looks weird and they don't know what to say.
She's beautiful. She's only the size of my hand. And she's two. It's a little mini jacker. I'd love her.
Mini Jack Russell?
Yeah.
Oh, I have a Jack Russell mixed with whatever you're having yourself.
And I think he does as well.
Yeah.
I think the jury's still out on your dog, Terry.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's questionable. Like.
Yeah.
Like, she can't bark or anything. Yeah. And she's two. But it's a good thing, no?
Maybe she's just an introvert.
Yeah. She's a shy dog.
Hinking.
Yeah. She's all mental.
Dogs are the best. Yeah. But Jack Russells tend to be a little bit barky though, don't they?
Yeah, very yappy. Yeah.
They're good for mice. They're good for mice and
rats. Good for minding the house.
Yeah, yeah.
If there's anyone at the door, you'll know about it.
Definitely.
Yeah, and anyone who comes in and they're not familiar, you'll know all about it. Whereas my dog, like, Jesus, anyone could be at the door and he'd be like,
come on
in. What
do
you want me to do? Yeah, what do you want me to do?
Showing them the stereo in this way.
The
money's in here.
Yeah.
There's cash in there in that drawer.
Putting the kettle on and all.
How are you keeping? I know, obviously, you're flat out lately. The book and odds that they're coming out. How's things though?
Well, I guess the book is called Busy and Wrecked. So I guess I can't say I'm busy and wrecked because then I can't really help people to deal with being busy and wrecked if I can't handle it. But I have a lot on, but it's really interesting. But I'm so much better at managing myself these days in terms of not just running around like a blue arse fly and telling everyone that I'm wrecked and busy. Because that's what the book is about. It was when I started to notice everybody, just that's how conversations start now. How are you? Oh, geez, don't talk to me. I'm absolutely flat out. I'm slammed. Jeez, I'm here, there and everywhere. You know, and I started to wonder, what the hell is happening? Why are we just telling each other how busy and wrecked we are? You know, because they're the two words that I just kept hearing over and over again. Have you told anyone today how busy you are?
I feel like you're mimicking me. That's all I do. Tell everyone how busy I am, and I'm not even that busy, and how wrecked I am. It's just all I do, yeah.
Well, what I'm trying to tell people with the book, one of the messages that it's not your fault, a lot of it, if that you're finding yourself telling everyone that you're mad busy and wrecked and running around, because there's science around the fact that we do infuse busyness into our conversations. We want to signal busyness to each other, and we use it to elevate our own social importance. There's science from Columbia Business School that shows that the reason we're telling people we're mad busy, we're up the walls, we're flat out, Jesus Christ, don't talk to me, is because if I can demonstrate to you that I have a lot on and very little time for rest and recovery in my personal life, then it means I have a high social status. I'm important. And they did studies on whether people, if you use online grocery shopping, because if you order the groceries to your gaff, you have a higher status again. And if you order those meals, I know you're two of your gym bunnies, yeah? Belting into the high rocks every 5 minutes. If you order the turkey burgers to your house because you haven't got time to cook or shop, the scientific studies show that we give a higher social status to those people as well. So this is why we do it. We're not even aware, but when you say, I am so busy, man, I haven't time to do anything, you're saying, I am actually quite important. And this is why we dish it out as a compliment. So yeah. I'd say to you, geez, lads, you're mad busy, aren't you? You're flat out. You know, fair fucks to you. It's me saying you're really successful. And you might be thinking, thanks, I'm having a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
But I guess it's good busy. And that's why we use the famous phrase good busy, because it kind of, it's our way of telling ourselves that, even though it seems completely unsustainable and we're all, you know, we've a constant heart rate of 182, that it must be good because this is what society is telling us. Busyness is good.
Yeah, you're trying to validate the fact that you have laden in the red zone. Yeah, your stress levels are through the roof. You're trying to validate it. Oh, look, I'm busy. It's better to be busy than doing nothing.
But that's the problem, you see, with the good busy, is that, like, the red zone is exactly how I see it. Like, I have a record player at home because I still listen to vinyl because I love paying 50 quid for an album I can get for free on my phone. But if I crank that volume too high, the needle goes into the red. Everything gets a little bit distorted. So a lot of us, we spend our lives with that needle, if not in the red, then just below it. So if anything else comes along, like more workload, you know, something you said yes to, but you think, shit, I should have said no to that bit of work or whatever. Maybe you've got a health challenge, or suddenly you're minding somebody you weren't expecting to mind. Then we can feel like, actually, the wheels are coming off here now. You guys are probably too young, but do you remember Buckaroo?
Yeah.
The donkey?
The game, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you keep piling the things onto the donkey. So we can feel good busy until that extra thing goes on, and then suddenly the bits are flying off.
Analogy, that.
It's just a poor reflection on the quality of toys in my childhood. Because Buckaroo always broke. Like, it worked for about an hour. And then it was just a plastic donkey that did nothing.
Yeah. We have a couple of zingers, Terry.
Oh, have you got zingers?
Yeah, Siobhan sent them in.
Okay.
So, Dave, have you listened to previous episodes?
Dermot.
I said Dave, yeah.
Yeah.
I told you already what happened this morning. I was talking to Dave.
And you called him Dermot?
Well, no. Oh, I was consciously saying, Dermot's on later. Dermot's on later. Dave.
Listen.
Dave.
I've been off the Dermot and Dave show for a year and a half more, and I still get called Dave. You're the third person to call me Dave today. I would never take offense. I'm honored because I love Dave. But it's just funny that we are interchangeable. I'm sure people get your names wrong all the time, do they?
No,
it's because
Terrence and Calvin.
It's so very distinguishable.
Bad hair.
Dermot and Dave is the thing it is, you know.
Yeah.
If it makes you feel any better, I showed up here yesterday to record this podcast. I walked in, everyone's like, what are you doing here? And I was like, what do you mean? They're like, you're not in until tomorrow. And I was like, April Fools was last week. They were like, no, and he pulled up the schedule. So I just sat here and I was like, I can't believe I'm not doing this.
But so, you know what? This is exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about in the book. Because when we're busy and we're a bit frazzled, our memory starts to go a bit iffy. And I have confessions of the busy and wrecked. I basically asked my subscribers to my newsletter, have you ever done something silly or funny like you did, turning up on the wrong day when you were feeling busy and wrecked. So like, there's people turning up the wrong day for everything. People driving to schools that their kids don't go to anymore to collect them. Dropping their kids off at the wrong school. Driving the wrong way to work. Driving to old jobs. Forgetting that they didn't drive into work and they got the train and walking down to the car park. Everyone is putting weird shit in the fridge. Like, I don't know what it is with the fridge, but people like putting their phone in there, their keys.
Yeah. One you ever found a spoon in the bin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sink you put in the bin and you're like, fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Putting like used tea bags into the fridge. Like, it's mad because if in that red zone, as you called it, when we're in that high stress state, your body's is going, look, I don't need to remember information. There could be a threat in my environment here. We're fight or flight. So we don't need to remember shit now. We just need to be prepared to fight or run away. So when we're in that high stress state a lot of the time, that's when we start doing these mad things. So I actually found it really reassuring when I heard everyone sending me these funny stories, because it was like, I just got the sense of that we're all just going around trying our best with loads of things to do, you know, and we're doing silly things and we're forgetting stuff and we're making fools of ourselves sometimes, but we're all in the same boat, you know? So I guess it's nice that way that you can just feel a little bit reassured that some days you think everyone else has their shit together and they absolutely don't. That's a given.
It's about reminding yourself of that sometimes, isn't it? Because it's easy to look and go, their life is just in check.
Totally.
Behind the scenes, it's fucking chaos as well.
Right, so we'll cut all of that with me making that mistake and we'll go again and I'm only joking. So,
say what?
Dermot, have you listened to any previous episodes of this podcast?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So are you aware of what a zinger is?
Remind me.
It's like a would you rather either or stuff like this, right?
Yeah, so I remember your licking the length of O'Connell Street.
Yeah,
yes.
It was a good one. That was a very good one. I enjoyed that.
Come up with that.
I don't know, but I enjoyed that.
This podcast gone to the dogs.
But our producer, Siobhan, has sent me two. So the first one is, would you rather get caught gossiping behind your friend's back about them or get caught going through your partner's stuff? So like, that's the phone, documents, letters, posts, all this shit.
Well, will I answer?
Well, yeah, it's open
to the floor. I'm trying to think as well.
It's open to the floor.
Well, like, I don't, that one doesn't really apply to me because she just lets me deal with all the kind of financial stuff. So, like, I'm in charge of all the documents and the stuff and the bank accounts and all that. So that wouldn't be bad, you know. I guess if I was going through her knicker drawer or something.
It's a little
bit
odd,
slightly more worrying. So I think I prefer to be caught doing that than bitching about my best friend.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer.
Yeah.
Have you got 130?
An answer?
Yeah.
I'm just going to agree.
Okay.
That sounds like a very good answer. Yeah. So we're going.
Have you ever gone through someone else's phone?
No.
I've never needed it.
Not interested.
Yeah. I've never needed it. Like,
I think if you find yourself doing that, there's something.
You're in the wrong situation. You should never have a situation where you have to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the second one is, would you rather live in a sunny climate and be at the risk of a water balloon or a cold one where you are constantly at risk of a snowball to the face? You'd have to say the sunny one with a water balloon.
A cold one with a snowball in the face is absolute torture.
Yeah.
You'd want.
That's assault. It is.
A snowball is hard.
Yeah. On a cold day.
It's like, do you remember when you were a kid and you'd be playing football with the cheap plastic balls?
Yeah.
And you get a blast of one of
and
them.
And it's imprinted into you then. Yeah. Oh,
yeah. I still have marks on me back and all over them, boys. I mean, that was torture.
Remember the ones that like Jack Russells used to chase? You know, the
blow away ball.
The air has kind of gone out of them and they're just like little rocks.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. If you got a toe peg, as we used to call it,
yeah,
a blast of one of them into the head, man, you weren't getting back up.
Yeah. Terence actually got assaulted earlier with a bottle of water.
I did actually, yeah.
We were sitting out on the balcony earlier and Terence and someone who will remain unnamed had a bit of a disagreement and your man just turned around and just threw a bottle of water over Terence.
Yeah.
So
it wasn't a disagreement. I slagged him as he was walking off and he sprayed water on me.
It's very EastEnders, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, in fairness, it's a lovely day. We were sitting on the balcony outside, you know what it's like. So he was dry within like 2-3 minutes, but we're still.
Yeah.
So at the point, I'm going to get him when he's in that computer room on his laptop and I'm going to drown him with a bucket of water. I will. I will.
Well, myself and Dave, In our first week working in Today FM, we thought it would be funny to make a video. We found this old laptop that was broken going into the recycling. So we thought, let's make a video. So he sat cross-legged at the top of the stairs, pretending he was working on his laptop. And I came by and I went, Dave, this isn't Google. What are you doing sitting there? And I flicked the laptop out of his lap and it tumbled down two flights of stairs. And he's like, what the fuck are you doing? And that we thought it was hilarious. The abuse I got. You wrecked his laptop. That's not funny. You're an arsehole. So it was like the most backfired sketch we ever did. So just, if you're going to do something like that, don't pour water all over this person's laptop.
We'll see what happens.
People don't like that.
No, Ireland likes high risk, high jeopardy. That's what he wants. He wants like the utmost carnage that possible. Like, he could get him when he leaves the building, but he knows it'd be more risk if he gets him in the building. You know what I mean?
And I have to get him back. I can't leave and have that one of me on the balcony. No way. I got him back at some stage.
His ego at risk here, you know what I mean? His ego took an awful hiding earlier on.
Reputation in the gutter.
Well, see, getting a drink thrown in your face, you never look... Like, if somebody throws a drink in your face, even if, like, they're completely in the wrong and they walk away, you look like you're guilty. If you've water drip, you look stupid, you look guilty.
You're drowned in guilt. That's guilt dripping down your face.
Just a little more. Right, Dermot, what we do with every guest, take us back to the start. Tell us, where are you from? What was life like growing up for you?
I'm from Limerick, County Limerick. Not the sticks of Limerick, but about 5 miles outside the city centre. So countryside, though. I would have grown up around hay barns, played in hay barns, jumped on the back of tractors, you know, climbed trees, all that good stuff. And I lived there till I was 18, then I moved to Dublin.
Why did you move to Dublin?
Because I went to college.
To study
archaeology.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. I saw Indiana Jones.
And that was it.
When I was 10. And I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Archaeology you studied.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to realise you don't get a whip and a cowboy hat and a revolver?
About half an hour.
That's a half an hour longer than I expected.
Well, I did go on a dig when I was in university and we went to Sicily and we were digging up a Greco-Roman village from about 350 BC. So it was sunny. I did have the hat. I made sure I had the Indiana Jones hat. Didn't have a whip because there was really no need for it. Let's be honest. It's not practical, you know. And I guess, you know, Indiana Jones was the world's worst archaeologist because he didn't document anything. He just went in and essentially robbed artifacts, you know. Made absolute shit of the building he was in because generally every building he went in collapsed after, you know, as he tried to get out. And so, yeah, took no record of anything and never asked for permission from the locals if he could actually go into the temple or whatever. Like, you know, he just had them with him getting killed by poisonous darts. You know, so he was a terrible archaeologist. But I loved it. You know, it was really interesting. But there's a lot of just sitting in a ditch brushing the earth. Do you ever see that show Time Team? Do you remember that show? It used to be on Channel 4. It was like archaeology on the telly, basically. And there was a guy with one of them accents, you know, like, I don't know, was that Somerset? Something like that. Yeah. You know, wow.
Farmer's accent.
Look what we found in here. Oh. And I had friends who were the archaeologist on the show, just in the background. Another one of the presenters was a guy, I forget his name, Tony Robinson. He used to be in a famous comedy called Blackadder back in the day. But he used to present it. What used to happen, though, my friends told me, is that they'd be in the ditch digging for weeks, you know, in the pissings of rain somewhere in the backyards of Cornwall or whatever. And then they go, oh, we found something cool. Like there's a bit of a wall or there's a bit of a statue or whatever. And then the presenters will come over and say, right, out of the hole.
No way.
And then they'd get in and they're like, you fuckers, I spent 3 weeks digging that thing out. And the cameras would come over and then they go like, okay, go. And then they'd pretend that they were digging it and they'd brush off the dirt and go, look what I found here. Oh my God, it's an amazing statue from ancient Rome. And look, there's Caligula's head. but yeah, they don't make it anymore. I guess archaeology on the telly isn't that fun. So I did that for 4 years, but then I didn't.
I was going to say, what ended up happening then?
I think I knew I didn't want to be an archaeologist because I thought I might have to study some more, and I wasn't mad into just studying. So I found it hard to kind of concentrate and sit in the library and all that. So then I ended up just filling in for a friend who worked in film in my 20s. And so I just was like a runner, and then I became a third assistant director, a third AD. So basically I made teas and coffees for actors on film sets. And if you're looking at a TV show or a movie where there's hundreds of extras, you know, or crowd scenes in a ballroom, whatever, my job was to organize the extras, you know, and you're not impressed.
That sounds like torture.
Yeah, it was a little bit like, I suppose, herding cattle at times.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I was good fun because you were, you know, I was working and you'd be up a mountain one day or in the city center the next day. And
yeah,
I just wanted to kind of be out doing something a bit different. And yeah, it was cool. So I was in film for about 6 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, was that kind of a path that you wanted to go down, or did you just fall into that? Or
I always was fascinated with telly and I wanted to be a presenter, but I was really anxious. And so I'm not very confident at all. So I ended up kind of working behind the scenes for a long time. And like, I remember going for an audition in RTE for a children's presenter's job. And that's, I really wanted to do that. But I was so nervous and anxious. And at that age, I used to sweat a lot and get like really embarrassed. And I couldn't do this. I'd be so bright red. And I just want to eat my own head out of shyness. And I remember I was sitting in the RTE reception waiting to be called in. And then somebody came out and went, "Dermot," and I went, "Yeah," and squirted my bottle of water. And there was a big pool of water. And then I put my foot over the pool of water. And then I could see the woman looking down. It looked like I'd pissed down my trouser leg.
Oh.
Then I went in, did an awful audition. And then that was it. So it took me a long time to get the courage to do anything like in front of a microphone or a camera. Like,
how was that such a drastic change?
Yeah.
Obviously, like, you're saying you were riddled with anxiety back then. Now, on the outside, it seems like you're really confident. You're sitting there, not a bother on you. What happens there?
Well, I suppose at that age, I wasn't aware that I had anything. Yeah. I didn't even know what anxiety was. I just thought I definitely got more embarrassed than other people, but I kind of didn't think about it too much. I don't know what my attitude, I didn't think I was that different to it. It was very uncomfortable. I remember doing an audition as well for a drama school in Salford in Manchester. And I really wanted to go to this kind of post-grad course to learn and to act and stuff like that. But I went to absolute pieces. Like I couldn't think straight and was just sweating through all my clothes. And I don't know what was going through my head. I just wasn't very self-aware. And then I used to just drink. You know, I knew after 3 pints that I'd kind of settle. Yeah. And that was just kind of me. I just thought that was me. But I wasn't aware of anything called anxiety or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And when I started working in news, I remember I was working as a newsreader for about the first 3 months doing okay. And then my throat started to close up reading a bulletin one time. And then I had to stop reading the news for a few weeks because one of the symptoms of anxiety sometimes is that your throat will close up. And I guess what changed for me, well, I'm a meditation teacher, so that has obviously helped me an awful lot over the last 15 years or so. But I had a big panic attack when I was driving to perform at a comedy festival. So I've always had this thing in me that I want to get up and do stuff. But for many years, it was like I had 1 foot on the accelerator trying to do these exciting things and challenge myself, and another foot on the brake going, "Oh, fuck, this is terrible. You're going to mess this up." And I think a lot of people have that sort of friction in their mind, you know, there's like a little civil war going on that they want to do stuff and they want to test themselves. They want to give that presentation or make that best man speech, you know, or ask that person out. But then there's this other thing then that's just their body is sort of resisting, you know, and that's what it was like for me. So I had this big panic attack and that kind of, you know, I guess made me, woke me up a little bit into, okay, maybe I could learn other ways of managing stress, you know, working out what is my body trying to tell me in these situations? You know, why is my throat closing up? Why am I, you know, drinking more than I'd like to be drinking just to chill out, you know? And I guess I was very cynical about meditation. I thought it was for total hippies. But I heard that the woman who was a meditation teacher who I met was teaching it to the guards. And I thought, Jesus, if the Gardaí are doing it and they're fairly stressed out, maybe it's not just for people who look really good in linen trousers, you know?
So you said you were doing it on the way to a comedy festival.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're incredibly anxious and shy and trying to hold yourself back. How do you take the leap to go on stage for comedy? Because that's like the biggest leap to take in terms of validation from a crowd.
It's a weird thing. And a load of comedians have it. Like, it constantly comes up, public speaking, as in the world's top fears.
Yeah.
It comes after, like, dying a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know? But I think a lot of comedians have a lot of shyness, anxiety, but they can't help themselves. They need to get up. And I think from talking to them, a lot of them, when you're in the flow state on a stage, and I'm sure you guys have felt it with all your public appearances you're doing, that's an amazing feeling. And weirdly, if you're in that flow state, I was talking to a neuroscientist about this on my own podcast, and one of the factors of being in flow state is that the critical voice that's judging you either gets really quiet or goes away altogether. So if you can get into that performance flow state, actually, even though it's on a stage in front of people, it can feel like a really peaceful place because you're not judging yourself. That little, you're going to fuck this up voice disappears. So I think that could be one of the reasons, because you can find a little bit of peace in performance, weirdly. But it doesn't always go like that. You know, as you know, some nights you just have a stinker and you're beating the crap out of yourself, you know. So I think that could be one of the reasons. But, you know, usually you find anyone who wanted to be an altar boy as a kid had the desire to be a performer, because that a lot of the time was the only stage in town that you could get up onto.
Yeah.
Once a week you could be up there, you know, and you got wardrobe, you got cool clothes, you got weird jobs, you know. But the girl you fancied could see you, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, who doesn't fancy an altar boy? Don't answer that.
Yeah, leave it. I believe that one will answer.
You said that you weren't really self-aware either growing up. When did you become aware that it was anxiety that you were suffering with? Or should I say suffering with? Is that the right thing to say?
Yeah, I suppose you would suffer.
Yeah, I suppose I was suffering. There were times I was really uncomfortable. You know, I'd say it was definitely, I guess probably my mid to late 30s, when I started presenting the Republic of Telly, I was quite comfortable still in front of the camera. But I think that was just when I became aware of, you know, there was times when I was sitting there and I would be aware that my body wasn't in a comfortable state, even though my mind might have seemed okay. You know, and that's what happened. You know, when you have an anxiety attack, sometimes you're not necessarily worrying about anything. Your body just starts freaking the hell out. And that's what scares people, you know? So I guess it was probably a few years into comedy when I realized that, okay, maybe there's something going on here under the surface that I wasn't really aware of. And I think when you do start to introduce something like meditation, which I started in about 2010, if there's something going on for you under the surface, it's going to come up, you know? And that's why sometimes people can feel a little bit uncomfortable when they try a meditation for the first time, because the perception is put out there that as soon as you start, you're just going to be totally chill, you know, but it's not always the case. Sometimes they call it stirring the pond. So if you've got stuff going on, it can bring some uncomfortable things to the surface, but sometimes that's good in that it can sort of highlight stuff that maybe you can start to deal with, you know.
Yeah, so, getting out there. Yeah.
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 So, you're a comedian. You're on one of the biggest shows on the telly at the time, presenting that. How do you get into the radio?
Well, I'd started in radio when I was many years before, after I stopped working in film and I was 27, I decided I was going to be a newsreader because I could do a good newsreader impression. I knew nothing about news or current affairs or anything, but I knew how to say, at 6 o'clock, here are the headlines. You know, and I could do a newsreader's voice.
Very good, yeah.
You know, and because you spent years watching like Sky News, where people speak in this really strange way. Nobody else quite speaks like, I mean, if I spoke to you like this, you'd think there was something wrong. But weirdly, it doesn't seem strange at all when you're watching reporters talking on the news. Dermot Whelan, Westminster.
It's perfect.
You know,
that's class.
But it's weird.
Even the head movements. Well, there's no need for all this.
Yeah.
Just talk like a normal person.
Yeah, I know. So I that's why I started working in local radio in Ann Olivia, as it was called back then, just in a shed in Griffith College on the South Circular Road. And when I gave them a demo tape and they said, okay, come in, you can have a job as a newsreader, because the current newsreader was the lady who ran the station, and she's just, and now the news, and she'd open up an Irish Times on the table and just start reading out random articles. So I said, I know I'm not great, but I can definitely do better than that. Mm. So I used to rob the news off the 98FM website and then just read it out. So that's how I kind of got started. So I spent 2 years then working as a reporter and a newsreader. And then I started using the newsroom to make comedy sketches for the late night talk show that was on. A guy called Niall Boylan was on at late night. And he used to play my comedy sketches.
So I used to do like a Ronnie Drew impression, except they used to call him Johnny Brew and talk about growing up in old Dublin. Old Dublin, my mother would give me a bowl of sugared water for me dinner and a slap across the head.
So it was basically that, pretending I was one of the Dubliners. And then another kind of community update character called Martin Swan. And Martin Swan used to say, we're all gathering at the roundabout. And I can't even remember. It was just completely surreal, off-the-wall stuff. And so he used to play my comedy sketches. And then Des Bishop, the stand-up, came in and said, I like what you're doing. Why don't you come in and try 5 minutes of stand-up in the comedy club?
Fucking sorry, Dermot. Des Bishop got everyone in the country into comedy.
He did. Yeah.
We had Des Bishop on here twice, right? And I swear, the two times he came in, he was just naming people that he got into comedy.
Yeah.
And now you.
He must get commission or something, referring to people, does he?
In fairness to him, he was emceeing the international comedy club. He was running the comedy club. And he was very generous. He'd give you 5 minutes. Now, if you stank, you mightn't get asked back, you know. But if he thought you had a little bit of potential, he'd give you a go, you know. And I just thought it was so exciting.
Yeah.
You know, if a gig went well, I just had never felt a feeling like that, that adrenaline rush. And I compare it to like extreme sports. Have you ever done a parachute jump or something kind of mad? Have you done one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't the feeling after it like, Jesus Christ, that was terrifying and brilliant and yay!
I want to do it again.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And that's what it felt like, you know. And I actually did a parachute jump with another comedian, pal of mine, who's not doing stand-up anymore, but we both landed and went, oh, fucking hell, that was amazing. Stand-up is scarier. Yeah, I know. Then jumping out of a tin can at 10,000 feet. Like, but I think once you get that sort of performance buzz, then you're kind of chasing it. You're chasing that. And the thing you always find with people who start with stand-up, the first gig is always amazing because you've got all your friends and family in the room, practically filled it. They're all rooting for you. So you could be completely crap and they're laughing at all your gags. So you come off the stage thinking, this is a piece of piss. I can do this, no problem. It's the second and third gigs are the ones that put manners on you, because you go back out all full of confidence. And now this time it's all strangers who didn't pay to see you. They want to see the headliner, you know, and then you find out that it's harder than you thought.
Yeah, it's a jungle.
Talk to us about that though. So Des gets in touch with you, obviously at a 5 minute comedy slot. And then how do you make that decision to go, right, I'm just going to do that and then just go and do it?
Well, again, that was who I was at the time.
Yeah.
I loved the idea of doing it. I wanted to test myself to see if I could do it because I thought, you know, who doesn't think that a stand-up comic is, you know, to do that would be a cool job if you were good at it, you know? And I'd gone to comedy shows and it wasn't even the performance of the comedian that I wanted to emulate. It was the fact that I used to see the comedians sit in front of the stage before they went on and they were all making each other laugh. And I just thought, I'd love to be sitting at that table.
Yeah.
Imagine sitting at a table full of comedians. That'd be fucking great. You know, so I think that's what I wanted to experience as much as anything else. But I felt sick for about 3 weeks, I remember, before my first gig. Every time I thought of it, my stomach would do somersaults. And then when I went to do the gig, I remember the night, and I had a guitar. I used to do like comedy songs. And Des was introducing me. He's like, our next performer's a do-do-do-do-do. And as he's introducing me, my wife, who was sort of very nervous for me, she just was, don't do your song. And I was like, what? And then Des goes, Dermot Whelan. And I was like, why the fuck did you say that for? Now this is, I'm closing my set with it. So anyway, I did the song and it worked.
Did she say that?
She just got suddenly afraid and thought, no, don't do it. It's not going to be funny. You're going to die in your hole.
I can imagine everything going through your head. Yeah. That's the way she's at the
set. It was like slow motion, like, what? Don't do the song? So anyway, yeah, I did it. But when I think back at the stuff I did in the early days of, I remember writing a song called What Do Dogs Think About When They're Going to the Toilet? Because you know the way with dogs, if you see a dog, when they start to do a poo, you'll see they get this weird expression on their face, kind of like, you know that? Have you seen your dog do that?
My dog goes a little bit scarlet, I think.
Yeah. They get kind of embarrassed.
Yeah.
But they're
so vulnerable, aren't they? That was like, but can you give me some reassurance here? Like, go on, you're doing a good job.
Because I think Dave had told me possibly one time that what they look at you because they are vulnerable.
Yeah,
they want to make sure
security
that,
or something,
that you're keeping an eye out, that there isn't a predator who's going to jump on them. But they do get this kind of, they're all confident, like, row, 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 get away, row, row, row. And then they're like, so I wrote a comedy song about what they're actually thinking about, which I can't remember, but I know I died in my hole several times singing that song.
Yeah. And what's that like then? So, what's it
dying
like?
Dying in your hole.
But I mean, like, because I'm trying to envision you back then being like shy and introverted and then managing to get onto a stage and do a set, but then dying in your hole. What's that like for you then?
Is that not like your biggest fear lived then? And you're like, oh, this is what I was afraid of and now I'm living through it. Why did I do this?
Yeah, you're having all those thoughts. And the inner voice is there as an extra audience member giving you shit as well. Like, look at you. What are you even doing? You're wasting your time. They think you're a moron. Look at you. You're dying in your hole. You're sweating. Look at you. What are you saying? You're not even making sense now. You don't have that voice. And that inner voice, my God, that was really harsh in my head for all my, I guess, the first half of my life, at least, that voice. But it's not easy. But I guess, you know, every comedian has to go through the dying on your hole because that's how you get better. You have to.
Yeah.
Because it makes you, you beat yourself up and it feels crap. But then you go, okay, how do I not make that happen again? So maybe you tighten your stuff or you pull out the stuff that doesn't work and you get a bit more, you know, a bit cleverer maybe with your writing and all that. But, I, the worst is when you do a shit gig, but your mate did really well. Like I remember I did a gig in Hoth Yacht Club and I absolutely died in my hole and I performed that song about what do dogs think. And it so didn't work. And then Eric Lawler was on after me and absolutely killed. Like they were rolling around. And when that happens, you can't blame the room or the crowd or the lights or the microphone, you know, or the lighting or the time of day or the acoustics, you know, which comedians we love to do because your friend has just absolutely nailed it. And I remember I was walking behind Eric and a guy came over and went, oh my God, to Eric, you were fantastic. You're the best. Oh my God, you had us in stitches. The other guy was shit. And I was like, Eric looked at me and he's like, that's showbiz.
You can imagine Eric as well, big happy head.
He can't help himself but be happy. Yeah, I'm taking the compliment.
Man, I've seen Eric do so many amazing gigs in, like that guy could do a gig like anywhere. I saw him do a gig in a kitchen one time to like nine people. It was this really rich guy.
He invited
us to do a thing for basically him and his mates.
Yeah.
And I thought, I think I barely survived. You know, I did a couple of minutes and then Eric, of course, came in and absolutely blew the doors off.
I thought you were going to start that previous sentence there, but I seen Eric dying on his hole loads of times to get him back.
No, I've never seen
down, yeah.
I've never seen Eric Lawler do a bad gig.
Yeah.
I hate him.
Fuck Eric, yeah.
I'm still trying to get my head around all of this, Dermot. That like, you're telling me all these problems that you're having and how anxiety is overwhelming and how physically it's affecting you, not just mentally, but yet you're still pushing yourself out there in like the worst case scenarios in front of a crowd, presenting, reading the news on the telly, on the radio, but on the backside of it all, you're like, this is the trailer I'm pulling behind me.
Yeah.
Are you having this conflict yourself, like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, stop putting yourself in these situations. Because to me, it's just like the jeopardy is through the roof. Yeah. And like the risk and the reward seems so low in terms of like, you could go to a different line of work where you wouldn't be suffering like this. And if you fucked up in that line of work, it's not going to fall back on you. And the voice in your head is not going to give out to then. But you're like, no, fuck it, I'll just stay up here.
Yeah, I think you can get addicted to just that high stress state, that those massive peaks and troughs, you know. And then I was sort of self-medicating with booze. So, you know, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I was definitely, you know, a Thursday to Sunday drinker, you know, a passionate drinker, you might call it.
Yeah.
But I guess I was trying to even out the peaks and troughs, the highs and lows, you know, with alcohol. And I think that's what a lot of people do. But that's a great analogy that you had, that, you know, I'm pulling this heavy caravan behind me. And I think a lot of people can find themselves like that. They might just be in a regular office job or whatever it happens to be, or maybe social situations are the things that they find really hard, but they're still going out and they're still going to weddings and they're still putting themselves out there. But it's just harder for them than other people because of this sort of that push-pull thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when I guess we can lean into the things that can take the edge off a little bit, you know, and make social occasions a little bit easier, or the come downs. Like the highs off a good comedy gig would be so high that I'd end up having 5 or 6 pints just to bring myself back down again, you know? And then you're kind of constantly chasing that. And so even my radio work, I was on doing early morning radio shows. So, you know, I was pushing myself, you know, working on a lack of sleep, you know, and I was just used to living life in this weird, edgy place, you know? And I think a lot of performers get it almost becomes home living in that edginess. You know, broken sleep, booze, you know, the adrenaline, and you get that kind of crazy cocktail, and it can be quite addictive. And it sounds weird that you'd get normal to living in that, you know, get used to living in that space, but it can become kind of normal. And I guess it was for me, and I just thought that's the way I operate. Mm. But then I learned, thankfully, that you don't have to live in that space because it's exhausting, you know, and eventually your body will just go, we can't do this anymore. So, you know, maybe you have a big drunken incident that kind of scares the shit out of you. Or maybe you have a big panic attack. Or maybe your relationship goes to crap because your mood is all over the place. You know, it will eventually catch up with you, I think, you know. But I suppose the gift that meditation has given me is that it's a way to see my own behavior, because you start to just become aware of the voice in your head. And but also it's given me another tool, a healthier tool, just to find a little bit of less of this and a little bit more of that. You know, it's not to say I don't get stressed or I don't have those nice adrenaline buzzes from time to time. Of course I do. You know, I still like to perform and it still scares the shit out of me from time to time, you know, but I don't have that heightened anxious reaction and feeling around it like I used to, you know.
Do you get that?
No. And someone only pulled me literally a couple of hours ago. I was getting lunch and someone pulled me, and it was close to the office, and the fella walks beside my office and he was like, oh geez, I'm walking, blah blah blah, and he was like, hang on, you walk and you do your podcast and you do this and you do that, where do you get the time? I said, remember last week when I was sick, I took 2 days off work and I was just sitting in the house dying sick and I was nearly pulling my hair out because I'd nothing to do, just sit there and just be sick. And I was like, I'd much rather be on the opposite end of the scale where you just constantly go, go, go. I think I get more anxiety and stress and pressure not doing anything.
But on a show, see the way he's talking about, obviously you know I do, but you're good at hiding shit as well. So like, see, on the day of a show, like we're constantly just reassuring each other that it's going to be grand, it's going to be grand. Then we go and do the show and it is grand. But I'm more like, fuck, 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 fuck. And I don't know whether he hides it or not. Do you know?
No, I think I'm... Remember I tried to say to you before, to try and help you with that, that we're both experiencing the same thing. Same symptoms, same occasion, same environment, same everything. I was like, my heart rate is racing. My palms are sweating. My breaths are getting shorter and shorter. But I look at that as excitement.
Yeah.
And you were like, I'm nervous. I think I'm excited because I was looking forward to it. You know what I mean? And I was like, is this just the perception that we have because we're both going through the exact same thing.
Mm. Yeah.
We're both going to experience the exact same walk and everything else and what we have to do. But I think I'm just more looking forward to it.
But when I worked with Dave, he was exactly like that. So he would be, you know, this is going to be great. And I'd be thinking, I'd be going through all the stuff that could go wrong in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ. What? Oh, no, the fuck is the thing's gone, you know? And, you know, in our early days of our radio show, if something went wrong, I would be, that's it. Oh, my God, I can't believe I said it. Fuck's sake. And it would colour the whole rest of the radio show. That would be me just in a shit mood. Oh, God, can't believe that went wrong with the thing. Dave would be like, so what? Well, just, it's fine. Move on. You know, so that's the way I was naturally wired to. And I had my brain scanned by a neuroscientist. And he's like, you are wired basically for hypervigilance. So if I walk into a room, it'll be different to how you walk into a room. So I will be scanning body language. I'll be hyper aware of anyone who possibly is looking at me in a way that isn't positive. And that will create a little bit of anxiety. This will make you prone to thinking what could go wrong. Now, sometimes that's hypervigilance, you know, it can work both ways. Yeah. This is what I've learned in recent years. That worked against me all the time because I was Willy Warrior. Oh, Jesus. You know, if I messed up something, I'd be focused on what I did wrong. I'd be worrying about what could go wrong the next time. I'd be sweating, anxious, freaking out. Then it would go well. I'd survive it. But then all that would start again as if I'd never done it well at ever any time in the past. Now I see my hypervigilance, that brain wiring, as a superpower because I've got a handle on the effects of stress on me through the simple meditation techniques. And we can do one if you want later on. So now I'm able to enjoy the fact that if I'm on stage, I can read a room really quickly. So whether it's a company, you know, with 12 people there or the Bord Gáis with 2,000 people there, I can read a room really quickly. I can pick up if someone isn't feeling well or has something on their mind, you know, which makes you a better listener, sometimes a better friend because you're picking up on signals maybe other people aren't. So I see that anxious wiring as a superpower for me now, as opposed to that foot on the brake that we were talking about earlier. That's something that was literally stopping me from doing the things that I wanted to do. Now I see it as a friend, you know.
Mm.
And that little inner voice that beats the shit out of us, that, you know, the volume on that has been so turned down. So if that does pipe up from time to time, you know, maybe it actually is right because it was wrong a lot of the time before, you know. I think it's great that you're wired differently because you're bringing different skills to the party. You're going to be thinking ahead and possibly going through some stuff that you do need to be thinking about that could go wrong, you know. And you're there to bring balance and help him to enjoy the experience a bit more. And that's what Dave always did for me. It's like, it's cool. We got this. Enjoy it.
That is the exact dynamic.
Yeah.
Between us, especially backstage. Like, you're talking 10 minutes before the show. Like, I'm just going off the walls. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah.
But it's crazy because I say all the time, Dermot, it's like, I worry so much about, like you're saying, sometimes it's normal things, and then sometimes like, what if I forget how to talk? I'm not gonna forget how to talk, but it's just a matter of stuff that you're thinking of.
Yeah,
it's like, I feel so much comfort 1 minute into the show. So like, I go out onto the stage, and then it's just like, oh, I'm actually all right. It's only all the things that you're thinking about and never actually happens. Like, yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and they don't 99.9% of the time, don't think, but you know. Your stress response, once it's activated, isn't thinking logically because you're not in the logical part of your brain. You're in the reactionary animal part of your brain. So it's primed for threat. So it's going to heighten everything, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I learned that Navy SEALs are using these techniques and, you know, I've shared them meditations with UN peacekeepers out in the Lebanon who are in particularly difficult scenarios, you know, the Irish rugby team are using these things. So if all these, you know, elite performers and people in really difficult scenarios who have real threats, you know, can use these techniques, then why can't I use them, you know? Because we're all wired, you know, we're all made of the same stuff, you know. But I think I just love those kind of dynamics, you know. And I always wonder, were Dave and I brought together because of that, you know, he filled in the skills that I didn't have and vice versa, you know? And I think that's what makes a great duo.
Yeah.
Is that you're both complementing each other's skill sets, you know? Mm. But I think a lot of duos work that way as well, you know? And that's why having a good pal is so important, you know, and that you can kind of just help each other out as you go, you know?
Yeah, of course, yeah. You mix comedy and meditation, don't you?
Yeah.
How does that, like, how did you even come up with that idea? Because it's hugely successful, like. But to me, like, if you said to me, there's a comedy meditation show on tonight, I'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, you sound like my audience. But that's what I hear a lot from people, you know, going, I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
You know, and of course you don't. I mean, comedy and meditation, I say, it sounds like I'm mixing MMA and flower arranging. It just sounds as this weird, you know, juxtaposed combo. But when you think about it, I think comedy and meditation are two things that bring you into the present moment. So like, if you're having a belly laugh with each other or another pal or something, it's very hard to be anxious about the future if you're just laughing, yeah. You know? And this is why people go to comedy gigs, because when they're laughing and enjoying, literally your cares go away because you're present, you're fully there, you're just in the moment. And we're happier when we're there, you know? And if you've got something on your mind and you think, oh my God, I'm just going to be thinking about this, and you go to a comedy gig, it disappears. It'll come back, but, you know, so they're very related, you know. Meditation is something that pulls your mind out of the future and out of the past, and so does laughter, so does comedy. But most importantly, I've discovered that if you can help someone to relax with comedy or humor, they're less resistant and their minds will open up to things that maybe they mightn't have been into. And I get a lot of men at my shows. And I've been to a lot of wellness shows and, you know, spiritual weekends and, you know, those kinds of courses, meditation courses and things. And I'm either the only guy or, you know, one of a handful. And it's 98% women at all those things, because it's that whole world is marketed very much towards women. You know, I was having a chat with a woman the other day about it, and she's like, God, I never even noticed that. And I was like, yeah, like even the graphic design around a, you know, a wellness event, it'll always be a woman on the front in the lotus position, or, you know, and the language, it'll be called something kind of feminine sounding.
Mm.
And a lot of blokes just don't feel part of the conversation, you know. So I love to see lots of men at my shows. They'll come, and maybe some of them might have been sort of encouraged along by their partners. And at the start of the show, they're like, you're not going to get me with your woo-woo nonsense, you know. And then you just start making them laugh. And I talk about my own experiences with anxiety and the panic attack and crying in the doctors because I was so burnt out. You know, these were kind of traumatic events, but because I can tell them through comedy and laugh at myself and laugh at us being human, they start to open up a bit, and you can see people's body language change. And then the most amazing thing is you see, you know, a whole room of people laugh in 1 minute, and then the next minute they're all sitting there with their eyes closed, you know. And that's an amazing, that never gets old for me, you know. And people come out quite, Jesus, I've never been to anything like that before, you know, because you're bringing them to two very different places, but in a way, you know, you're giving them kind of permission to be okay with themselves, you know. And that's, you know, you can't help but feel kind of different after that happens to you, you know.
Yeah. See, the idea, obviously you had to come up with an idea and how you're going to run a show like that. What was your thoughts going, were you thinking this can go blading anyway here, or did you know like this could work?
It originally stemmed from, you know, I felt like there were two parts of me. So a few years after I got into meditation, there was me, the performer, on the radio, on the telly, doing the jazz hands. And then there was this other kind of meditating, quiet version of me that no one really knew about. But I felt like they were two separate people almost, like, you know, Bruce Wayne and Batman, you know, and I didn't know how I was ever going to kind of bring the two together. So then I thought, God, maybe I could start to weave something a bit deeper into my comedy, you know. And I remember at one gig in Vicar Street, I was one of the comedians on the bill, and I got everyone to do a big long, you know, deep breath into their belly and then let the breath go, and absolutely killed the gig. And when I came off stage, the MC was like, what the fuck are you doing? You just killed the room, you dope. What are you getting them to do breathing for? You know, because if you're a comedian, you want your audience
he's
kind
of energy.
Excited, energized, a little bit pissed, but not too pissed, and up for it. And I come out and go, take a big deep breath.
They're all asleep.
And they're all like, yeah, hey, thanks a million. So the next comedian who comes out is like, has to work 50 times harder to bring the energy back up. So it didn't really work in the early days, but it kind of changed for me. Well, one week I was doing a gig in the Three Arena with Dave, and it was a Paddy's weekend, lots of comedians on the bill. But that would have been my dream since I was a kid. Imagine doing a comedy gig in an arena. You know, and this should have been the greatest thing, moment of my life. And I did the gig and Dave was like, that was unbelievable. That was amazing. And I was like, meh, grand. And I was driving home and I was like, what the hell is wrong with me? Like, why am I not walking on air? 2 days later, I did my like one of my first meditation talks where I was trying to make meditation funny to about 20 mildly interested people in an insurance company on Tara Street. And I did that and I came out walking on air. I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever done. I want to do this forever. And I guess that was a big thing, that there was a moment that I was like, okay, I guess my passions are kind of changing a little bit. And what's important to me is changing. And that desire to just be the funny guy jumping around on stage was, I guess, what I wanted a few years back, but now I want something a little bit different. And I could see if you can make something a little bit humorous and funny, it will connect with somebody, you know, and that's a magic feeling. I just love seeing someone who might be resistant to it, but struggling with the same things that I was struggling with. But if you can make them laugh and then they open their mind and they try something and they go, okay. You know, because my meditation teacher told me for something to click with somebody, you need three things to be right. The message, the messenger, and the timing.
Mm.
And for a lot of people, it's hard to get those three things, particularly for men dealing with issues with their mind. You know, they might understand they want to do something. Maybe the timing is right, but they just haven't heard it delivered in a way that they can relate to. You know, maybe it's just they keep hearing it from people that they probably wouldn't have a pint with.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the more different ways you can present this stuff, and particularly using humor, the more people you can reach, because they mightn't have heard it delivered like that, you know. And my teacher, David G, who I ended up learning from, I heard him, I came across him online, and he was making this stuff kind of funny. He had a sense of humor. And I was like, wow, you can actually mix these two worlds, you know. And I was thinking, wow, I can mix my two worlds.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be Batman and Bruce Wayne. I can be the same. I think what happened in that insurance company, I realized I was bringing more of myself to the table.
Yeah.
And that's when you feel fulfilled. And you think, shit, I want more of this, you know.
Yeah. So you're in the wellness kind of industry, I'd say, what, about 10 years, a bit more?
I became a teacher in 2018. So, yeah, so maybe 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Then. Did you find that was a taboo there, you know, when people hear wellness, you're very quick to dismiss it. It's like, oh, that's early fruity or very fluffy. It's very hard to get people on board.
I think we're much more open to it now, you know. But again, I still think people are resistant to it because it does sound airy fairy a lot of the time. You know, if I came on here and started talking about, well, you know, your chakras, half the people are gone straight away. You know, that's not to say anything bad about the people who are into that side of things. If you're into the more, you know, the new agey side of it, then great. But there will always be people who aren't into that, you know. And again, mostly blokes aren't into that. They're a little bit more resistant, you know. So if I handed you guys little crystals and said, hold those to your heart now and fill them with your intentions, and then we'll go down to the Liffey and we'll throw those crystals into the water and you can get rid of those negative things, you'd be like, okay. You might do it once to humor me, but maybe you mightn't. Maybe you would be into it. I don't know. But again, I think that's why I think it's really important to talk about these things in different languages. Like my son, he's mad into the gym. Right? He's 17 and he just wants to eat handfuls of creatine. That's his life purpose. He wants to work out in the gym. he had no interest in meditation, none whatsoever. And especially if his old man is talking about it, zero interest. One night we hear him, meditations, guided meditations coming. I could hear them through his bedroom door. Myself and my wife were like, what the hell is happening there? Like, did you tell him to listen to it? No, did you tell him? And what had happened was we had gotten him a Fitbit. And as part, he got this like 6 months free of whatever the pro subscription was. And as part of that, he'd gotten workouts, but also guided meditations. So he connected with it. So when it was presented to him in the world of fitness, activity, exercise, getting strong, healthy body, healthy mind, he was like, okay, I can relate to that. But if I'd gone into his bedroom with a handful of crystals and started burning sage over his bed, he'd be like, eh? You know, and it's the same. If I can make you laugh and then talk about, you know, the same techniques that the Navy SEALs use, you might go, yeah, okay. You know, so it's the message, the messenger, and the timing. It's how you hear this message and who you hear it from can make a lot of the difference, you know?
Yeah. You said you had an exercise earlier that you were going to do. Will we do it?
Do you want to do it?
Yes. Okay. So take off your clothes.
Right, no problem. Go on the camera's off.
Yeah. I'm only joking. Just the bottom half. Guys.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
Let's keep it civilized. So there is a very simple technique, and there was the one first one that I learned that I know that it was being taught to law enforcement. And the Navy SEALs call it tactical breathing. They don't say meditation because that sounds a little bit airy-fairy to some people. But if you call it tactical breathing, now it sounds, yeah, hoorah! Yeah. And sometimes it's called square breathing or box breathing. Maybe you've tried it before.
I've heard of athletes doing it.
Yeah. Athletes do it, exactly. Yeah. So if athletes use it and the Navy SEALs are use it to get a little bit of kip in a war zone, why can't we use it before we go into the pub if we find it hard to meet people, or before we do that presentation, or before you walk out in front of a live audience, you know? So all it is breathing in for four, holding your breath for four, letting your breath go for four, and holding for four. And there's your square, your box. Now, as a little tester, think of something that is kind of has been on your mind, and maybe your listeners could too, something that's been sort of niggling at you.
Have it.
Yeah? Don't go too deep now, because I'm not a trained psychologist. And if you start crying...
Sobbing.
Oh, didn't she text me back?
Okay, something like, yeah, that little niggly thought. Yeah, okay. Right, so one hand on the belly, right? This works best when you put your hand on your own belly, okay? Yeah. But if you want to lean over, go for it. You can do reach around meditation. So... So all we're going to do is breathe in for four. Okay, you ready? So breathing in, two, three, four. Hold, two, three, four. Let the breath go, two, three, four. And hold, two, three, four. Now just breathe normally. There's the end of your 16 seconds. Did that thing that was on your mind disappear for a couple of seconds? Yeah? Now sometimes all we need is that. We just need to break the cycle of rumination, of thinking. Because when we're wired for heightened anxiety or a heightened awareness of our surroundings, like you and me are, we will tend to overthink stuff. Those thoughts will keep going. But you need those thoughts piled on top of each other like a Jenga tower for that anxiety to continue. So if you can break that just by doing what you did, sometimes it's enough to set your day in another trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly like, I never want to remove stress or remove a little bit of anxiety. I don't want to be, I get worried if I'm totally chilled out and I have to do something like this because I won't be thinking fast enough. You know, if Katie Taylor's in the ring, she needs that stress response active so she can move and make better decisions in the moment and move quicker, you know, and think quicker. She doesn't want to be totally chilled out, but she doesn't need that same stress response when she's trying to get a kip 6 hours later, you know? So coming into this, I want a little bit of stress. Stress is good, short-term stress, helping us do our jobs properly.
Yeah.
But I don't want that stress overruling everything and my thinking and everything that's coming out of my mouth. And I don't want to be living in the future while I'm talking to you thinking, oh, Jesus, what if I say something stupid? I want to be here. So I want a little bit of fizz in the belly, but I just want to take that needle out of the red. And that's exactly what you just did there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. I'd love to know if I was on my own doing that in the gaff, like with that walk. Because I think when you're more conscious, or maybe if you're more stressed, because I'm not so stressed right now, I'm all right. I think when I'm on my own,
you've
I'm
been clamped.
Thinking. Yeah. But yeah, thinking that a little bit more.
Yeah.
But when, like, I'm in the present moment here. Like, obviously, I'm thinking of the next question or whatever. But it's like, I'll be walking home later on and be going, fuck, we have a live show in about 2 weeks. What have I fallen? Yeah. You know?
And did you find that exercise hard? Because some people find it difficult. Focusing on their breathing can make them feel a little bit even more anxious sometimes, because they go, oh, and you know, you can feel almost heightened anxiety for some people. Yeah. Focusing on your breath. Some people find it hard to sit still, and that's okay too. You can take this meditation for a walk. If you're someone who likes to just be moving, you could walk for, what I do is I walk for 6 paces. If my mind is particularly busy, I'll go, okay, I'm going to go for a walk, but I'm not just going to think about the annoying shit all the way around the block and back. I'm going to break that cycle. So I'll breathe in for 6 paces. I'll hold for 6 paces. I'll let go for 6 paces and hold again for 6 paces. And I might do that 3 or 4 times throughout my 10-minute walk. So I'm moving. So I feel, you know, I'm not just sitting there, but I'm still getting the benefits of it. You know, so you can play around with the techniques, because it's kind of like music. You can find a style that suits you, that connects with you a little bit more, you know.
That's the one thing I love about meditation, is the awareness and the presence of it. That you're like, oh, I'm listening to myself. I'm aware of stuff I wasn't aware of in my own body. And I wish more people would look at it that way. If we could take like the taboo away from it. Like, you know, like kind of like the spiritual side of it all.
Yeah.
And people were like, do you know what? Actually, I took a breath there. That didn't feel right. Why can I not take a deep breath? And then they go and they look into that and, I don't know, maybe they have an issue or whatever.
Yeah.
Now they go and get checked from just being present in the moment and listening to your body. Or you might be really stressed about something. And then you're like, do you know what? Actually, if I had to handle this situation that way, I wouldn't be this stressed. So now I'm going to go and do that and I'll address this issue in my life. And now you have to remove on that stress factor. And that's just from being present in the moment. And I don't think a lot of people do that now. It's like, we just get on with it. As you said, like, you're busy and wrecked, but you just get on with it, because we're all busy and wrecked. And it's great being validated, because, like, well done, you're busy. That's the great thing about the book. What I found about it is that it's applicable to everybody. Joe Soap. It's not like he's a high-performance athlete. He's a CEO. She's running this business. It's like, no, this is just somebody that's off an 8-hour shift. They're busy and wrecked as well. And these tools can apply to all these people mentioned. Because we are all living in this world and it's getting faster. The world is speeding up. It's not slowing down.
Yeah.
I know, like, there's all this stuff to make your life easier. My life doesn't get easier. It's getting more stressful. So it's all about finding that balance. And hopefully people can read the book, Dermot, and find it useful and find it, like, do you know what? I'm going to do that. Even like a simple bleeding, simple exercise like that, 16 seconds. You know,
that's a little starter, you know, and a lot of what I hate, you know, I hate when I see someone in Instagram or whatever telling me I need to do something for an hour in the morning. I'm like, who has an hour?
No,
that there is what turns me off.
No one has an hour. Jerry Hussey, you know Jerry Hussey.
Yes, yeah.
He says you give yourself 1% of the day. That's 15 minutes in the morning. It's 1% of your day you're giving yourself.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? 1/100th. Of your day is 15 minutes.
We did a 16 second. Maybe start there.
And that's
maybe
start, if you got, just build.
Because what that will do, it will blow the I haven't got time excuse out of the water. You know, I'd love to meditate. Love to get into that mindfulness stuff, but I haven't got the time. Do you have 16 seconds? Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
You know, if you can do that before you pick up your phone. I always learned it from my teacher, David G, was rise, pee, meditate. Okay. If you want to make this a habit, get up in the morning, do your business. Get that weird look your dog gets. But then before you pick up the phone, try 16 seconds. Maybe you could do a minute of just feeling your belly rise and fall with each breath. Something as simple as that. Maybe I have 12 free guided meditations with the book. If people want to just slide into the passenger seat and let me guide them. Use one of the apps, whatever. But I see it as setting your Google Maps for the day. So you wake up, you do your business, and then you can just sit up in the bed or lie down in the bed, whatever you want, and just do something. Do say the 16 seconds. And what you're saying to your nervous system is, okay, this is how I want to feel today. Everything may not go smoothly, but this is how I'd like to respond to the day rather than just react and bounce around the place like a busy and wrecked pinball. This is how I want my nervous system to feel today. Just nice and calm and present. And then at any other time during the day, if I feel like my head is frazzled or I catch myself telling everyone I'm mad busy, I'm running around and flat out, I'm swamped. Okay, maybe I could do another 16 seconds and just reset. And that'll just start to get you into that habit of just stepping out of the busyness for a second, you know. Mm. But if you can do it before you pick up the phone first thing in the morning, the minute you look at a news feed, your cortisol levels are up by 20%. They've done Harvard studies on this where if you look at 3 minutes of negative news first thing in the morning, at the end of the day, you're nearly 30% more likely to say your day didn't go well. So, and you know, and if that keeps happening to you, then you feel like your life isn't going too well.
Mm, yeah.
Now you could watch an uplifting story. You know, I'm not saying you don't look at anything. If you watch like they did studies of people who watched like positive stories of, you know, an 80-year-old man passes his driving test and gets his license back or whatever. Those people at the end of the day felt like their day had gone even better. So you can feed yourself stuff from your phone, but if it's good stuff, yeah, it can have a positive effect. But I think the real power, the real ripple effect is if you can just bank this little bit of self-care first thing in the morning before you pick up the phone, even if it's just one conscious breath, just like the rugby players do in the middle of the pitch in a huddle. They're just breath into their belly, hold, and then long exhale. Boom. That's how I want to feel today, you know?
It's class.
Yeah, I'm all over it. All over it. Dear man, I know you're here to plug the book. Is there anything you want to mention with the book? Where can we get it?
You can get it in all good bookstores, as they say. You should be also, if people can't afford it, they haven't got the cash right now, or maybe they just bought a book and they're in the middle of that, you will be able to borrow the book from the library and BorrowBox. I know that app, a lot of people use that as well. So it will be out on Audible and Kindle and all that kind of stuff, but it's in shops now.
Are you going to do the audio version of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have to do like a trial run for that? Who had to do a trial run and think
Mark Meegan had to audition for his own book.
He told me that. Yeah, yeah.
But he got it.
You know, he got it, yeah, but he didn't think he had to audition. He thought, I wrote it, so like, when do you want me to do that? And you were like, oh no, you have to audition. And he was like, ah, and the woman was like, no, like, you have to audition. And he was like, but it's, they're my words.
Like, I know, but you don't own the words, you see, after you've written them. But that's the thing. I always thought, of course I read the old book. And people were like, God, you're lucky you got to read your own book. And I was like, what? Because you imagine, like, you spend...
That was me reading your book.
But imagine, well, look, you're at least you're a professional presenter. Like, yeah. I'd happily hand it over to you. But you imagine you give it, and it's like, how you doing? Here's your book. You know, like, because you've no control over who would read it, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, but the worst thing is the first time I sat down to read my audiobook, I started finding typos. And you're like, oh no.
Fairness, that's not your fault. That's the editor and the publisher's fault.
I think it's a mixture. We were able to save it. It was early enough.
Yeah,
that's a good save there.
Yeah, yeah,
he's
yeah.
not hanging
there
though.
Yeah, he was like, yeah,
hey,
support.
No, it was all of us.
He's gone for the hat-trick of books.
A team effort. Good save. I love audiobooks as well. You know, they're a nice way if you have a long drive or something like that.
I love them, and I hate it when the author isn't reading. I'm like, oh, and it's like, oh no, but that's his lifelong friend. I was like, I don't care. It's not him. He wrote the book, let him read the book.
Especially David Goggins, his audio book isn't read by him. And what I love about him is how passionate he is. And you're like, right, lovely. And then this soft-spoken fella comes on, you're like, okay. Yeah.
Stay
He's
hard.
Talking about doing these 160-kilometer runs and his feet are broken. Yeah, his little soft voice on him saying it. I'm like, man. But David Goggins comes in. Joking.
Tell your inner bitch to be quiet. Yeah. Like, oh, okay, I will. Yeah, thanks.
But at the end of every chapter, I'd say they do like a live segment in the audiobook, which is mad, where he actually comes in. He's like, so David, at this part, when you broke your feet, blah, 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 so on and so forth. But he's not reading the book, and I think it's strange.
Yeah, and he's an absolute beast. There's something about the name Goggins. You know,
Ray Goggins.
Ray Goggins. Yeah, the Irish former Army Ranger.
Yeah.
Hell Week.
Huh? Yeah.
He was telling me about when he used 16 seconds. He was in a, I can't remember what, I think it might have been Afghanistan. And he was got out of bed, put on his uniform, was walking down the corridor to breakfast. And a bomb went off outside that was blew all the windows in, blew him back down the corridor and back into his bedroom. And so he's like, you know, classic, like, you know, you see in the movies, like the ringing ears.
Shell shock, didn't it? That's what they call it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was like, oh, and part of his thing, this training that kicks in straight away, is the first thing he does is tactical breathing. So what we did, he does that 16-second technique and gets himself present, and then he checks, okay, am I okay? Where's my gear? And then up. And all that would happen, obviously, just like super quick.
Yeah.
And then he gets out to see how his comrades
are.
I done a talk with him in Alberstown. And he had a group of like teenage jumpers who were like, don't want to do this. Who's this fella coming in giving a talk? 5 minutes later, they're all sweating in the hall, doing laps. They're all tied together.
Push-ups.
Yeah, they're all tied together. So, you know, like, they're trying to run laps of the hall while they're all tied. So they're like, the quickest fella is pulling the slowest fella, essentially. And they're all the, like, the people who work there, they're all laughing. They're like, he's had a break in them. And, you know, you can hear them giving out. And he's just like, shut up. And he's like, but nothing, shut your mouth. And you're like, fuck, he's scared.
He's very scary, yeah.
And he's a gent. That's the thing about it. It's like, oh, how's it going? Yeah, I'm Ray. Yeah, next while he's just roaring the head off you. And you're like, fucking hell, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah. Shitting, like.
Yeah.
But so the audiobook is coming.
Right now the book is for sale in the shops. And if you're into this stuff, I do have my Mindful podcast. So we talk about all kinds of things like we were talking about. So I talked to Cillian Murphy, who won the Oscar, talking about flow state and what's going on in his head, how he deals, you know, things that get him into flow and things that throw him out, and just really interesting stuff.
That's a great plug. Yeah. I'm going to kill you more.
Yeah.
It's like what we did. We're like, Eddie Hearn was on, you know.
Yeah.
And many more.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just love talking about this stuff. I just think it's like, not that I'm any good with cars, but it's like, for me, it's like looking under the bonnet of your car and learning how the bits work. And going, okay, so when that happens, I get stressed. And when I get stressed, this thing happens. And all right, that's why I was sweating. I mean, throat was closing up when I was reading the news. And the more you can learn about just how we react in stressful situations and the things that we do right and do really well as well, you know, it feels better just knowing this stuff, you know.
Right up my street. I'm one of those like graphic learners. I need to know, how do you get from A to B to C? You know what I mean? Like, break it down. So I know the system, I know the approach. And you're like, I understand that now. And that's it. Mm-hmm. I get it. You know, that's why when you had the hand on the stomach there, I was like, I'm so present here. Mm-hmm. Like, I can feel my whole body here. I know exactly what's going on. That's me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
But I think it made that very interesting there as well. Like, I'm sure there could be ways for me to have sat here and went, maybe with somebody else, or maybe if it explained it a different way, I'm like, I'm not into that.
Yeah.
But I sat here for the whole time, very interested, and I think it's the way I delivered it. So thanks very much for coming in. That was brilliant.
Thank you, lads, and keep up the great work. I know you guys talk about this stuff all the time, and it's massive, you know, it's massive, particularly for us blokes. We need to hear this stuff over and over again, you know, because we tend to wait till bits fall off.
Yeah, yeah.
Till we hit crisis point, you know.
Yeah.
I would say, so, you know, a woman will go into the doctor, and the doctor will say, how long have you been feeling like this? Like, a while. How long's a while? God, a week. Okay. A bloke goes in, it's like, how long have you feeling like this? A while. How long's a while? Since I was 9. <You know>? So it tends to take us a while to come around. So what you're doing is massively important.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Damon.
Thanks, lad.
Anything else you need to plug while you're here, Damon?
Oh, God, no.
Social media.
No dates aren't coming up.
No, I've just finished a live tour, so just the book. Thanks, lads.
No problem.
Yeah, so get that and the Mindful podcast. And before we wrap up, a big shout out to our sponsor, FBT.
All gyms offer huge gym floors, so you won't be struggling for a bench on a Monday night.
FBT are Hyrox affiliated and have a heated vault, offering free classes in both.
Recharge and recover after a big session in the recovery rooms.
Whether you're a beginner or a seasoned athlete, FBT provide the resources, motivation and expertise to empower your fitness journey.
Unleash your potential at FBT Gyms for only €44 per month with no contract, full class access and locations in Swords, Coolock, Drogheda and now Talla. Sign up today at fbtgyms.ie. All right, take us out, Siobhan.
Boom.
Talking bollocks with FBT Gyms. Unleash your fitness potential with no contract and full class access. fbtgyms.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more.
knock off.